This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show for your Friday. Good to be with you today. Matt and Patrick here. Coming up a little bit later on, an exceptional actor with the Guthrie, Tyler Michaels King, is going to join us. He plays Hector McQueen on Murder on the Orient Express. He'll talk to us about that. You've got to go see that. The staging of that play is insane. It is so well done. We'll be talking with Tyler coming up here in the 4 o'clock hour. But, Patrick, just to be honest, it's not too often I have my choice of jackknife tipped over swine trucks to talk about as far as stories go. But, shockingly enough, today I've got two that fall within that qualification.
One is a literal one and one is a figurative one.
So, last night. I am at my daughter's graduation. We were over at U.S. Bank Building, where barely anyone survived. If you hadn't heard from the Republicans, we had to run for our lives. No, it was actually a delightful night. I'm still not going to pay. I don't care if the Vikings aren't playing in there. I'm not going to pay $9 for freaking cheese curds. I don't know what your idea is. And by the way, maybe have one more than one person there. If you're going to have a few thousand people in the at U.S. Bank Stadium working the concession stands, that might be a good idea. I have no idea who the heck Bree Baxter is, okay? But Bree, for Minnetonka, Bree, hi, how you doing? Good to chat with you. If you are wondering who that person was that when they announced your name during graduation screamed, yeah, that was me. Now, I have no idea who you are, Bree Baxter, but that was the exact moment I got the buzz that Donald Trump had been indicted on. What is it? Is it 37 counts or is it 38?
I've seen some conflicting reports on that, but 37 was the initial.
It's a drunken baker's dozen right there. Okay. I have to start. I'll tell you what. Should I actually go with the pigs first? The actual pigs? Why not? Because the lanes are open. It's breaking news. Matt's back to his old traffic duties. Eastbound lanes of 694 in Little Canada reopened. And that's it. All right, I'm not going to do any more traffic on that, okay? But they've reopened right before noon today. An hour-long shutdown after a semi-trailer overturned and hogs it was carrying got loose. Well, they're now part of the metro area. And as I said, I think it's their highway now. I don't see how we can really – I think that's case study law. I don't know if we really can take it back.
I think this gives a new meaning to the term left lane hog.
Oh, yeah, there you go. There are so many you can go with. there were like six on Bacon alone I came up with almost instantaneously. State troopers who initially arrived at the scene attempted to corral several loose pigs, and cameras showed running through the traffic on 694 in the West Junction and 35E. Immediately after the mishap around 7:35 a.m. So that would be kind of over. Yeah, as you're getting up to that turnoff for White Bear Lake and everything. Oh, that must have been delightful. Skid loaders and wreckers were brought in to upright the truck, clean up the mess that tangled morning rush hour traffic and led to a back of more than a mile, said MnDOT. Authorities also rounded up the pigs, including some which were injured. Aw, poor piggy. I was just watching. You watch the original Earthquake, 1974? Charlton Heston. I'll shoot the earthquake. You ever seen that one?
I don't think I have.
There is a scene with a cattle truck, and it does not end well. As my daughter said, they're not going to kill all the cows in the cattle truck, and yes, they do. Well, it's toy cows, but still, it's an earthquake. That's unfortunate. Motorists were detoured south on 35E while the lanes were closed. They reopened much sooner than 1 p.m. opening. MnDOT, the truck driver, was not hurt, said Gordon Shank. God, you can't make this story up. The officer who responded
was named Shank. Okay. Get Sergeant Porky over here. Captain Bacon on the phone, sir. All right, thank you. I'm sorry. The guy they quoted was Shank. Okay. Lieutenant, you're delicious. I'm sorry. Sorry, Lieutenant. You're just doing your job. I have no doubt you did not want to have to deal with pigs this morning. But it's yeah. Needless to say, don't drive pigs and be reckless. I don't know what the safety, the more you learn sort of thing, you know, rainbow star thing we do. I don't know what we're saying with this, but do they have all the pigs or do we now have, what is that, Little Canada? That's Little Canada.
Yeah, Little Canada, Vadnais Heights, around that area.
Little Canada is now, do they have their own wild pig hordes? Wow. Sorry. Okay, Little Canada, that sounded worse than when I said it. I was like, oh, yeah, that probably doesn't go over well. Nothing against the fine folks of Little Canada, but still, watch out. They get mean when they go feral, man. They get mean. We're going to have a showdown between the turkeys of the Northeast and the pigs. This is going to be like, you know, an animal version of the Jets and the Sharks sort of thing going on here.
West Side Story.
Yeah, that's what we're going to have going on there. I'll put money still on the turkeys. Those guys are tough, man. You don't want to mess with them. 952-946-6205. Now that's the actual story of the overturned truck with the pigs on it. Let's go to the metaphorical story of the overturned truck with the pigs on it. Federal prosecutors unsealed the indictment laying out the government's case against former President Donald J. Pig. Trump. Detailing their allegations that he mishandled classified documents after leaving office and obstructed the government's efforts to reclaim them. No, you've got to see this to believe it. They've released photos of the storage situation they had at Mar-a-Lago. And as once again, these people have kind of tried to argue that this is one of those things where, you know, so you're Mar-a-Lago. Mar-a-Lago is a sensitive area. Okay, first of all, I'll just describe the pictures the best I can. Go find them. And by the way, a quick side note before I get down to this. I'm going to get to Tom Emmer and Pete Stauber and every other Republican who's desperately trying to come on about, what about Joe Biden, huh? Well, sure you got this, but what about Joe Biden? I think it sure is a coincidence that this is being filed. Joe Biden, dudes, ladies, gentlemen of the Republican Party, you need to go see this and read this before you start opening your mouth. Because for lack of a better way to say it, this is just Trump trying to get caught. For lack of a better way to say it, there is no excuse. There is no whataboutism. Someone asked me, he's like, well, do you think Joe Biden has done something like this? No, I don't think Joe Biden had a bathroom full of boxes of classified documents with a chandelier, by the way. What the hell? What 1980s nighttime soap opera are you trying to mimic, dude? It is, you need to look at this. Now, Nixon, I want to go through three Republicans who had scandals. And all of them were bad. I mean, let's just be honest with it. But I want to point out the metamorphosis of this. Let's go back to Harding. Now, Harding, until Trump, pound for pound, might have been the most corrupt president we ever had. His entire administration was the biggest grift of all time. I mean, they it's the only time in our country's history that a former cabinet member was actually charged and I believe convicted of a crime, had to be extradited from Europe as he fled to Europe. they were the Teapot Dome scandal, the military vet scandal. There were so many scandals within his administration, and he himself exposed it because he died. He died, and it's alleged that he died while he was with one of his mistresses, but, you know, Christian values, that sort of thing. What you have there is a Republican administration who hid from the Republican Party what they were doing. And once it got exposed, the Republican Party themselves went after him pretty hard. And, well, not him because he had passed away, but his administration. And it was ugly. And there was actually a lot of laws that were passed to stop people from doing what these guys had done and profiting the money. I mean, they were going out and they were in charge of building veterans homes after World War I on the West Coast. They'd go on out, scout at a site, then go buy it for peanuts and then sell it back to the United States. You know, go buy, you know, basically what was useless land for, you know, pennies on the acre. And then charging a premium price for downtown New York back to the United States government. It was that kind of shakedown. It was, and they did it all over the place. I mean, it really was disgusting, but it was something that was kept really within the administration. Nixon was different because there were a lot of people who weren't in the White House that knew what was going on. And if you don't remember the case, the Watergate break-in happens, find out that these guys are getting paid somehow money from the Republican, the committee to elect Nixon, money was getting to them, which led to a lot of questions, which led to the White House itself, because there were people that were within the campaign to reelect Nixon and working in the White House at the same time or had just formally left. Needless to say, it was intertwined. And it was a case where there were a lot of Republicans that were aware of it. But what happened eventually was when it came to light, when it was undeniable, when they had the definitive proof that Nixon himself was guilty and had him on tape, that's when, because the gig was up, Republicans went to him and said, we don't have the votes to keep you in office. You better leave on your own, basically. They gave him the opportunity to resign, which he did. And I want to remind people, there are a lot of Republicans that feel as if that was wrong, that even if they knew he'd done something wrong, they should not have made him resign. And that they were betrayed by Republicans themselves. So they have now created, now we're getting to our third administration with Republican corruption, and that is the Trump administration. And what they created was this rule that basically the man could murder a Girl Scout live on television in the middle of Fifth Avenue, and they would do nothing about it. It was something he bragged about. He bragged, I can do this. And all the Republicans said, yeah, you sure could. I'm not going to put any kind of, stop to you on doing that. So murder away. He admitted he could do this. Many Republicans say they could, that he could. What he seems to have done, and this is the demented inner machinations of this delusional man-child, the most narcissistic human being that's ever, ever been in government, is he basically said, well, I'm going to make you have to defend me shooting the Girl Scout in the middle of Fifth Avenue. Because when you look at what he has done, it's not even really a question. For God's sakes, he has admitted to most of the crimes himself, proudly. So he's admitted to many of them. We have undeniable evidence of them. We have photos of the classified documents, boxes and boxes and boxes of classified documents just thrown anywhere at Mar-a-Lago. The first one, I'm going to describe this to you. First one, this is in the ballroom which, you know, it's tacky to say the least. I mean, it's one thing if it's 18th century France. It's another thing if it's Florida. It's the stage on this ballroom. And on the stage is two deep, 40 boxes of confiscated documents in a room that apparently was used with the boxes in there. So they had dances, gatherings, get-togethers, and all the classified documents are right there. And by the way, we're not even getting into the real stuff here either. There's another picture of him. This is about the neatest storage of documents. This looks like some sort of storeroom, and they're stacked against the wall. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 high. Is that 7 high? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Yeah, 7 high to the back. But still, what's with all these documents? The third picture is just, this is apparently in a storeroom that many people at Mar-a-Lago had access to. This was not a locked room. This was a storeroom there. And one of the boxes is just a box tipped over with classified documents all just strewn across the floor in this storeroom that people had access to. But then the coup de grace is the bathroom pic, because this is a picture of, first of all, the tackiest freaking bathroom I've ever seen. It's Vegas on shrooms. It's what in the hell? I mean, you've got this grandiose framed mirror and this black countertop sink. You've got, what looks like a Menards toilet. But the light fixtures, he's got one light fixture that looks like it was a nipple piercing for a British royal. The ceiling chandelier is just tacky. This is in the bathroom. The bathroom. They got the chandelier. But what the other thing I've noticed about this is that as he's done this, there still is just like a Target toilet trash can there. And then the shower curtain looks like it just, came from a Walmart or something like that. So it's just total Trump. I put a chandelier in the bathroom because it's so glamorous. But everything else there, if you just look around for a second, everything else there is like, dollar store trash. In this bathroom, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 stacks of boxes. Right around the toilet, by the way. Apparently, the shower is also full, but we can't see in the shower because the shower curtain's pulled. There are 6 stacks of boxes right around the toilet in this bathroom. I we're out of toilet paper. I guess I'll use this nuclear capability of Australia briefing. What are you doing? Seriously, Stauber, Emmer, Fischbach, the Beeve down in the first district. Whatever your name is. God, what is that? Finstead, that's right. The Beeve. God, that's going to stick. The Beeve down in District 1. Before you rush out to say, he littles it, Biden, why are you not going after Biden? Realize you've been done in by him. He has gotten so brazen. He's admitted to most of this. He's not even trying to hide it. I mean, he's Tobias in Arrested Development trying to play Mrs. Doubtfire and clearly still being Tobias. No one is fooled by this. And yet you're sitting there saying, that's Mrs. Doubtfire. So before you go on out there, might I make the suggestion that if you can't just sit there and say, dear Lord, this is an embarrassment, this man needs to be held accountable, then just shut up. Because there is no what about that's going to counterpoint this. Take a break. Come on back. I'll break down the charges when we do return. New York Times has been having fun with this as well. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. So let's read. This is from the New York Times. Federal prosecutors unsealed the indictment laying out the government's case against former President Donald Trump on Friday, detailing their allegations that he mishandled classified documents after leaving office and obstructed the government's efforts to reclaim them. One second here. There you go. Jack Smith, the special counsel who is bringing in the case, said in a brief remarks on Friday that the rule of law is a bedrock principle of the United States. We have one set of laws in this country and they apply to everyone, he said. The investigation was being conducted with utmost integrity, he said, and he promised to seek a speedy trial. He did not take any questions. The indictment gives the clearest picture yet of the files that Mr. Trump took with him when he left the White House. It said that he illegally kept hold of documents concerning United States nuclear programs, potential vulnerabilities of the United States and its allies to military attack, and plans for possible retaliation in response to a foreign attack. Now, I want to stop right there because he's basically giving up the ghost here. He took documents that basically refer to the United States nuclear program, potential vulnerabilities of the United States and its allies to military attack, and plans for possible retaliation in response to a foreign attack. So it wasn't like he just shoveled a bunch of papers into a box and then basically just took them and didn't realize what they were. Oh, here's that one bill I was looking for 4 years ago, and here's little Billy's artwork. No. He specifically went and got things that referred to the United States' nuclear capabilities, potential vulnerabilities of the United States and its allies to military attack, and plans for possible retaliation in response to a foreign attack. Of course he was going to sell this to the Russians or whoever would pay him the money. Come on. Why else would he have this stuff? Why would you, as a souvenir, bring back for your house potential vulnerabilities of the United States and its allies to military attack? Of course he was going to try to give this to a foreign country for the highest price. And we should remind ourselves there's a crap load of empty damn folders there where the information that was in them is gone. And Johnny Security here basically had these things just anywhere. I guarantee you, the Chinese, the Russians, any other country was in Mar-a-Lago and was out searching those boxes. It is a disgrace to think. This is a guy who said, what could I sell? He's the loser who walks into a hotel room and says, I'm taking the ashtray. An ashtray? You don't smoke. Still, I bet I could get a buck for it. He stole things that were specific to the security of the United States. Because clearly, come on, enough's enough. He was looking to basically make a few bucks from one of our enemies. Traitor. The indictment names one of his personal aides, Waltin Nauta, N-A-U-T-A, Nauta, as a conspirator who assisted in the obstruction investigation of the former president, retention of sensitive defense documents, and his residence and resort in Florida. Prosecutors presented evidence that Mr. Trump shared a highly sensitive plan of attack against Iran to visitors at his golf club in Bedminster, New Jersey, in July of 2021, and was recorded on tape describing the material as highly confidential and secret while admitting it had not been declassified. So once again, I want to make sure we talk about this little nugget as well. And by the way, Pete Stauber and Tom Emmer running out to defend this guy. This is not Mar-a-Lago. There has always been this speculation that he might actually have more documents that he has not released to the public. And this was in Bedminster. This was in New Jersey. And he's just showing it. It's a plan of attack of Iran. Wow. He knew it was highly confidential. He said it was highly confidential. He said it was secret. He admitted those things. He also admitted it had not been declassified. So when he goes, he waved his magic hands over the boxes and they were all declassified. He himself admitted they weren't declassified. I'll tell you what, I'll take a break. I'll take a break. I got more to get to on this. That's for sure. More to get to on this. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. Coming up here in the 4 o'clock hour, Tyler Michaels King is going to join us from Murder on the Orient Express. That's currently over at the Guthrie. They're there till July 2nd. I highly, highly recommend go seeing it. And if you have a kid who loves theater, take them to go see it because it's rare you see a staging this good, even in Broadway. I will say this. The staging of this play is as good as you see in Broadway. Or London. It is that good. You've got to see it to believe it. Murder on the Orient Express over at the Guthrie Theater playing until July 2nd. Go get tickets. And Tyler Michaels King is going to join us here at the top of the hour. I got to talk to him as well. He was in The Tempest. He was phenomenal in The Tempest, too. So it's going to be fun chatting with him. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Hey, let's go back to the indictment of the former president of the United States, shall we? Uh-oh, there goes another truckload of pigs tipping over. Wow. In another incident in September of 2021, he shared a top secret military map with a staffer in his political action committee who didn't have security clearance. The filing includes many pictures of what appeared. By the way, can I just say, I can already see what the eventual defense is. He's a simpleton. You know, I don't know why you guys, he didn't grow up in politics. He just, look at him. He's half drooling as it is. How can you hold him accountable? Same exact people who, when a 13-year-old black child is involved in a crime, charge him as an adult. They know what they did. With a 70-plus-year-old ex-president, you know, he's just, you know, you can't really get mad at him, you know. The filing includes many pictures of what appear to be banker's boxes, some containing highly sensitive material, which were haphazardly moved by Mr. Nauta and other aides at Mr. Trump's behest. Some of the boxes appear to be sagging, which would mean maybe they got wet. And, well, the bathroom, for goodness sakes. I don't want to even know. I don't even want to know the plunger bill for Mar-a-Lago. I don't want to know what the plunger bill is. Was that Mr. Trump? Clogged again, you said? All right, we'll be right over. Here's your problem. It looks like someone tried to flush down this, military map of Hungary. And also, you need more fiber. Sorry. I don't know what I came up with more jokes with faster. The pig truck actually tipping over or this pig truck tipping over. It's one of the two. The filing includes many pictures, which appears to be this, sagging boxes possibly. Well, December 7th, 2021, Mr. Nauta found that one of the boxes had toppled and spilled its contents all over the floor. The files that splayed on the carpet, which can be seen by anyone. Now, once again, it had fallen over and people had been using this room. File on the carpet included designations secret, RELTUS, FVEY, which means that they were meant to be seen by officials of the US, UK, New Zealand, Australia with high-level security clearances, or the part-time cooking staff at Mar-a-Lago. Mr. Trump is expected to appear in federal court in Miami over Tuesday afternoon with Judge Aileen M. Cannon. This is the hack that he put on the court. They're already saying that the DOJ is going to request that she be replaced. She recuses herself. She is scheduled to preside over the initial hearing, according to people familiar with the matter. It was not clear whether Judge Cannon, who was criticized by a higher court for handing Mr. Trump a series of unusual favorable rulings during the early stages of the investigation, would remain assigned for the entirety of the case. The indictment handed up by the grand jury of Miami is the first time a former president has faced federal charges. It puts the nation in an extraordinary position, given Mr. Trump's status not only as the one-time commander-in-chief, but as the current frontrunner for the 2024 presidential nomination to face Biden, whose administration was now seeking to convict his potential rival of multiple felonies. Mr. Trump continued to rail against the indictment on Friday, calling it the greatest weekend of all time, he wrote in a social post. The indictment reaches back to the end of Mr. Trump's term in January 2021 when the documents, many of which were said to be in the White House residence, were packed in boxes along with clothes, gifts, photographs, other material, and shipped to the General Services Administration to his private club and residence in Florida, Mar-a-Lago. Two lawyers, James Trusty and – okay, wait. Okay, let me – Patrick, really quick for you. Okay, what's the better name association? Shank with the pig, actual pig turning over, or Trusty with Trump? Which one do you find more comedic value with?
Trusty with Trump is that's a really good oxymoron.
Nicely done. Two lawyers, James Trusty and John Rowley, left Mr. Trump's legal team, will no longer represent him in the document case. It will be represented by Todd Blanche, Esquire. God, what doesn't that just – that's a name that just screams of Alabama billboard guy. A firm to be named later. What is this, a trade for a shortstop? The Twins get Carlos Correa, and in turn, we send $80,000 and a player to be named later. That's what we have. It's a firm to be named later. Call Nathan Thurm. Mr. Trump wrote on social media, a recording of him meeting with Mr. Trump in July 61, 6 months after leaving the White House, is expected to be a key piece of evidence against him. During the meeting, he described a document in front of him as classified and highly confidential, according to a person briefed in the matter. Now, once again, I will say the New York Times has been covering this as well and talking about a lot of different things that have been going up with this. One of the most problematic pieces of evidence for Trump, the indictment recounts how, according to his lawyers, Trump made a plucking motion. Plucking motion that implied, well, okay, I'm going to do the joke. All right, I'm going to just let you know. I'm going to do the joke. But, you know, I'm not happy with myself. I am inside my own mind. I'm being critical of myself, okay? Trump's lawyer said Trump made a plucking motion. Well, we've heard the stories from Stormy Daniels, so never mind. Sorry. That crossed a line. A plucking good line. Anyway, sorry. It's Christmas. It's freaking Christmas. Why don't you take them with you to your hotel room? Why don't you take them with you to your hotel room and then kiss them? No, he didn't say kiss them. He said, hotel room, and if there's anything really bad in there, like, you know, pluck it out. Was he talking about the confidential materials, or was this what he said to Stormy Daniels? And this is the front runner for the Republican Party. It's a live action version of Arrested Development. That's what we've got right now. I'm sorry. I know there are decent human beings that are listening to the show. I have no idea why. But you are there. You don't deserve this. I'm just a horrible human being. I'll take it. But I'm going to still laugh my butt off, man. The picture in the toilet is just – that's going to be my Christmas card this year. Oh, God, if you have someone who's moving and you want to send them a card, use that picture. That's the one you want to go with. It's going to enrage – this is Maggie Haberman from the Times. It's going to enrage Trump when he sees how much of his own staff and advisors cooperated with this investigation. The indictment reveals previously unreported text messages between two Trump aides who were trying to find a place to store the boxes at Mar-a-Lago. And as a matter of fact, here, Trump employee two, we can definitely make it work if we move these papers into the lake room. And this is a question, apparently. We can definitely make it work if we move these papers into the lake room, question mark. Trump employee one, there is still a little room in the shower where his other stuff is. It is only his papers he cares about. There's some other stuff in there that are not papers. Could that go into storage, or does he want everything in there on property? Wow. Prosecutors revealed that Trump had caused his lawyers to falsely certify a statement for the Justice Department last June. Lying, he got his lawyers making a false statement. Wow. His legal team had conducted a diligent search in Mar-a-Lago and found only a few files have been returned to the government. Prosecutors say that Christina Bob, his lawyer, signed the statement even though she had no role in the review of the boxes. Shortly after Bob did the false certification, officials from the FBI and Justice Department met in Mar-a-Lago with Trump and Bob, along with another lawyer. Trump declared to investigators it was this he was an open book. He has never touched a book in his life. And no, menus don't count. It's like a book, but there's food in there. I have the ketchup. Maggie Haberman again. Every aspect of the indictment shows a historic element of Trump's personality, his showing off, his beliefs that everything is his thrusting his advisors into untenable positions, his admiration for people who evade scrutiny. This is what I'm saying is you literally, because Republicans made the decision after Nixon that they would not ever try to hold someone accountable, someone came in there and took advantage of you. And look at you pathetic clown cars now rushing to his defense. It's indefensible. What's going on here? Trump is already attempting to turn his supporters' ire on Jack Smith, the special counsel, in Truth Social post. Trump attacked Smith's record on this case and called for his deranged psycho that shouldn't be involved with any case having to do with justice. Smith is noting that the country's laws protecting national defense information are critical for U.S. security and the rule of law is bedrock principle in the United States. Yeah, you don't. These are not things you share. These are not things you take. I have a security clearance. When I was in the military, I had a security clearance. I don't think I have it anymore. But when I was in the military, because of the nature of my job, I had a security clearance. And trust me, they were very clear. None of this stuff should have ever gotten out. I mean, and I'll give you an idea. I had a security clearance and I had to go through a lot to get the security clearance. And the stuff that they're talking about here is so far above my pay grade. I don't even understand. I can't even comprehend the background checks that people that actually can view this stuff must have to go through to make sure that they are trustworthy enough to see this. It is astounding. And so for him to have it just stacked around in a bathroom. This is from Ben Portes. Smith says we have one set of laws and they apply to everyone and very much look forward to presenting our case. There's obviously the question of whether or not why they moved it to Florida. I'm not sure there why they did that. Trump allies on the far right of the House Republican Conference has veered into making bellicose threats and sound like calls to arms. Representative Andy Biggs, Republican of Arizona, tweeted, "We have now reached a war phase, eye for an eye." Representative Clay Higgins, Republican from Louisiana, and I want to talk about Clay Higgins here for a second, appeared to summon supporters to Mr. Trump's arraignment on Tuesday. Buckle up. 1/50K, know your bridges, rock steady, calm, that is all, he wrote on Twitter, in apparent reference to military maps. Not only that, but he referred to the POTUS as Trump as the real POTUS right now. So this guy, Clay Higgins, Republican of Louisiana, he's actually calling for people to start, trying to take over the country. They're actually calling for a civil war. And one thing I can say about Biggs and I can say about Higgins, you're a bunch of cowards. Seriously. You're cowards. You are cowards. Because what are you doing, really? You're sitting in the safety and security of your Washington, D.C. office. You're sitting in your Arizona or your Louisiana office. You want other people to go fight your little war for you. Because you want to have some level of culpability. Well, just because I told people that they should go out and start a civil war, where did you get the idea that I was telling people to go start a civil war? That's what you're trying to do. And it's easy for you to go find these dim bulb idiot followers of you guys and Trump that basically are, yeah, but you know what? You're going to get people freaking killed. And no, let me explain something. You clowns might try to start a civil war. Me and the rest of this country will end it real freaking quick. You'll get to the and find out part of that equation really quick because you don't have a freaking chance. You like to think that there are masses of people that are on your side. The reality is the 10th Mountain Division will make mincemeat out of you guys. And you'll sit there and say, well, I don't know where anybody got the idea to attack the United States. Yeah, it came from you guys. You're a bunch of cowards. Whiny little biatches. That's what you are. And someone tell Biggs and tell Biggs and tell Higgins that I said it. I have no problem with that. Because as a veteran of the United States of America, you don't get to just pick and choose when all of a sudden you are a proud American. Trust me, I was embarrassed and frustrated and disappointed when Donald Trump was elected president. But at no point was I'm going to take my stuff and go to Canada. No, not going to do that. Still love this country. You guys, basically, all of a sudden, one bill gets passed you don't like. It's time to get armed. Start storming the buildings. Take over the bridges. Because it's all you've got. And you idiots are going to get a lot of people killed. You think you have the numbers. You do not have the numbers. And you're going to all of a sudden take over a bunch of bridges in Miami. And when the police come, what are you going to do? Open fire on the police? Maybe kill 7 or 8 of them? And then all of a sudden, one, it'll be just like the Capitol Police, where all of a sudden all the same people who say, I support the police, all of a sudden, well, not those police officers. They got in the way of my agenda. You're cowards. Biggs, Higgins, you're cowards. That's all you are. And you're going to get people killed. So if you don't like this country, get the F out. I'm saying that as a veteran of the U.S. Army. You don't like it here, leave. But you want to start this? Fine. We'll finish it. And you're not going to like it when we get done. Just ask the South. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. Prosecutors charged Trump with 31 counts of violating the Espionage Act. 31 counts of violating the Espionage Act. Unbelievable. And as I said earlier, I wanted to try to get to this here before I get to the break here. GOP Representatives Tom Emmer and Pete Stauber on Friday accused President Joe Biden of weaponizing the U.S. Department of Justice against President Donald Trump by indicting him through grand jury, though they provided no evidence of the allegations. Now, once again, I want to make sure we say that they're accusing him of weaponizing the Justice Department, who went through a grand jury. It wasn't like they themselves got an arrest warrant. They went through a grand jury. The grand jury said, yep, he's guilty. And so they want to ignore that. They want to ignore the fact that they didn't do this in Washington. He specifically didn't do this in Washington, D.C. He did this in Miami near Mar-a-Lago, and he still came up with these indictments. Emmer, who's the House Majority Whip and third-ranking House Republican, told Minnesota Conservative Talk Radio that Trump's indictment stinks too high. Stinks to high heaven. Isn't it funny? It just stinks. Well, what evidence do you have? Well, I don't have any evidence. I'm just saying it stinks because I just don't want to acknowledge the fact that I'm endorsing this. We got to get back to agreeing to disagree and not using the government or political adversaries. What if he actually committed the crime? Because I got photos of him committing a crime. Okay, I mean, there are photos of him committing a crime. What you're really saying is, well, I don't know why you're trying to hold someone who's clearly guilty of a crime of the crime. Now, let's get back to these hearings on Joe Biden, even though we don't have any freaking evidence to support our claims. I mean, this is Emmer, and like I said, in his case, the whole thing of irony is dead. We are not using the government against our political adversaries, as his house is currently running sham investigations into Hunter Biden, Joe Biden's son. Late Thursday, a Florida grand jury, not Biden, charged Trump on 7 counts. Federal prosecutors Friday afternoon unsealed the documents against Trump. And once again, it's the evidence against him is undeniable. It's unbelievable. Stauber, who's also appeared on far-right talk radio, implied federal prosecutors sought the indictment to distract public attention from Republican allegations. Biden was the recipient of bribes as vice president. Wait a second here. You need to talk to Tom Emmer's Pete, because you're sitting there and saying that we're weaponizing the government and we're doing a good job. He's saying, where did anyone start weaponizing the government? It's not a coincidence, in my opinion, said Stauber, referring to the incident. It's a bunch of malarkey. As a former law enforcement officer, I believe our justice system, however, it just reeks of politics, said Stauber. Once again, through a grand jury. No evidence to back up their claims. And they're only notice, these two clowns don't have the guts to come on my show. Tom Emmer, Pete Stauber, I want you to come on my show and say this. I don't want you to just go to some guy who's going to protect you on right-wing talk and only ask you, it's like, this is really a crime against Trump, isn't it? Yes, it is. Come on my show. Come on my show and make these statements. I'll show you some pictures and have you explain to me how that's good classified document storage. Oh, that's right. Both of you are cowards. Both of you are cowards. You're too afraid of me. You are. You are. You are. You're terrified of coming on this show. You are. Monday. Come on, Monday. Come on the show Monday. I'll make time for you. Come on, Monday. Both of you. Come on. Come on the show. I want to go back to what was the documents here. Because this is everything, really. They included information on the military and nuclear capabilities of foreign countries, White House intelligence briefings, and country support of terrorist attacks against the United States and militaries as well. It should also be noted that in these things were the United States nuclear program, potential vulnerabilities of the United States and its allies to military attack, and plans for possible retaliation or response to a foreign attack. Those documents, those souvenirs, for some reason, were in all those documents sitting around Mar-a-Lago. And Tom Emmer and Pete Stauber are defending that. That was okay. That there is nothing to this. This is just political. No, this could be the crime of the century. Hour two of the show, that's coming up next. Hour number two of the show here on your Friday. Good to be with you, Matt and Patrick. I could spend hours talking about Donald Trump's creative storage solutions, but we'll get back to that here in a little bit. If you have not been to the Guthrie for a spectacle, how about I say it like that, a spectacle of a performance, might I encourage you to go see Murder on the Orient Express. It's playing there until July 2nd. The staging of this play is insane. It was truly one of the greatest stagings I've ever seen of any production. Joining me right now to talk about the play, his role in it, as well as also the presentation, is Tyler Michaels King. He plays Hector McQueen on Murder on the Orient Express. He's kind enough to join us to talk about the presentation. Tyler, thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
My pleasure. And I want to actually say how much I enjoyed you in The Tempest as well earlier. I remember that.
Thank you.
That was a remarkable performance that my wife and I went and saw it, and we were like, wow, who was that? That was just brilliant. And that was just – I mean, you were fantastic in The Tempest when that was on the stage.
I'll say I look a little different between the two shows.
Yes, just a smidge. tell us of the quality of actor you are, but it also – here's where I'll combine the two. You have been on two presentations, two performances, where the staging has been pretty remarkable. The Tempest was good, but and as good as The Tempest was, what you guys at the Guthrie pull off here with Murder on the Orient Express is truly remarkable. It is a visual, just watching the show without really paying attention to the plot, it's just a visual feast.
Yeah, I think so. I think this is one of the best designed productions at the Guthrie that I've been a part of. And that's all due to the amazing design team that we had and our director, Risa Brannon. Just a really powerhouse creative team behind this show, for sure.
How much, as an actor on stage, I'm just going to give you a brief synopsis. Part of this takes place on the Orient Express, the train. And so the creative nature of how they've put this out there has the train moving back cars and cars. That's all I'm going to say about it. You need to go see this to believe it. But as you as an actor on the stage, how many performances have you ever been part of where there was actually this much of a moving set?
I think this is pretty unique. I mean, to have actual designed train cars on stage that move that significantly on a tiny stage like this. I mean, the Guthrie's not tiny, but to put a whole train on stage is kind of remarkable. And again, that the design team was able to do that is absolutely incredible. I think it's one of the most, as you said, one of the most spectacular production designs that we've ever had.
Well, and for you as an actor, it creates a very interesting element of hitting your mark because your mark is moving.
Yeah, for sure. We've in our tech rehearsals, we're sort of like jumping on and off the train, getting used to that for sure.
let's talk a little bit about the play. First of all, the play here, if I understand it correctly, Ken Ludwig, is this how old is this interpretation of Murder on the Orient Express that was developed for the theater?
It's pretty young. This piece was originally written, I think, in the 2010s, mid-2010s. So it's a fairly new production, for sure.
And it's been performed in many places? I mean, I was noticing in the notes here that it got performed in Europe for the first time just last year, June of 2022.
Yes, I think it hasn't been performed much, but there are several productions of it. I think because this story is just sort of resonates with right now, I think people want both sort of escapism theater. This show is really fun, really fast moving, and it's also like a classic whodunit, right? And I think the public just really wants those two things mashed together right now. I think it's perfect.
Well, and let's get into that as well as you talk about it. It is the classic Agatha Christie whodunit, kind of murder, and creates the story itself creates a great theatrical production because it truly is an ensemble piece.
Absolutely. I mean, there's, I think, 8 or 9 different accents happening on stage.
Yeah.
Every character who comes out and has their introduction, they're sort of in this, like, beautiful costumes, and this set in 1934, so it has that sort of classic murder mystery feel. It definitely immerses you in that classic whodunit Agatha Christie murder mystery sort of scenario, for sure.
Are you a fan yourself of Agatha Christie and whodunit readings, stuff like that? Is it something that's in your wheelhouse specifically?
You know, Agatha Christie is not, but I love a good murder mystery. Like the whole escape room thing, I'm a big fan of that. Mm. If there's like a new murder mystery that's coming out, I've seen all the Kenneth Branagh adaptations that have recently been coming out for, Death on the Nile.
Yep.
And this, too, A Murder on the Orient Express was a film. That was the first Agatha Christie that he produced. Yeah.
The writing here, and obviously there is with Ken Ludwig, he did have to convert a book onto a play form, but for the most part there, it is quick, it is precise. It is, this is a very timed, it's almost like a regiment on this performance. And you got to be kind of careful with it because I think this is one of the things I like about Agatha Christie is there's always these kind of hectic moments within the stories, whether it's her books or in the plays or whatever she did, that basically, are designed to almost to a challenge. And I think that it's challenged the viewer, challenged the actor and the performers there. I mean, it's when you do this, I mean, Shakespeare, you did the Shakespeare and Shakespeare is wonderful and brilliant, but it's a very different type of script and acting than what you see with Murder on the Orient Express.
It definitely is. And Ken Ludwig, he had to take a big old thick book and compress it down to about 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he took what was originally 12 suspects and he made it into 8, which is already sort of making the story all that more efficient. But you're totally right. I mean, the whole thing about murder mysteries is following every little line, every little clue, every little piece of the journey, and you kind of have to tabulate all of that. And even us as performers, we have to go on that intellectual and emotional journey along with the play. We can't be a step ahead of it or a step behind it. We have to live inside the moment of every discovery of new evidence, all of that kind of thing. So it is certainly super efficient. I think that's where Risa Brannan was just really remarkable in terms of directing this, because every ensemble has to be a viable suspect, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what makes these kind of stories so thrilling, and especially as an actor, to just live inside of that world.
Tyler Michaels King is joining us. He is in the play Murder on the Orient Express over at the Guthrie Theater until July 2nd here. And that's one of the things that's really interesting as well, is that when did you first walk into Guthrie rehearsal stage to start working this? How long before the presentation was ready for the stage were you taking part of this? Because these are not small, quick productions at any capacity.
No, not at all. We rehearsed about 4 weeks in the rehearsal room. So that's not on stage, not with the full production elements. That's just actors with, you know, some simple tables and simple props in a rehearsal room. We did that for about 4 weeks, you know, sort of investing in our characters, discovering the story with each other, building the sort of arc of the story, how we can sort of shape the drama of the piece. And then we spent, you know, about 2 weeks in the theater, because the show is so massive and has so many technical elements. Yes, the scenic elements of the sort of moving train, but also the lighting, the sound, all of the costumes and props. We spent about 2 weeks building that, which also included a couple preview performances, and then opened the show. And we've been running about 3 weeks to incredibly sold out houses. This has just been a bestseller for sure.
Yeah, my show was sold out. It was brilliant, and it's interesting because I'm a big fan of the Guthrie. I've been there for many years, and it's interesting. You go to a Shakespeare, and of course the crowd's full of Shakespeare people that know the Shakespeare in and out, and like that's like how they delivered the line. I just saw that at Hamlet, but now here you are, and that entire audience is full of Agatha Christie fans, and it's very interesting to talk to them because, as you said, it's not a direct translation. And a lot of people have read Murder on the Orient Express. I'm not going to talk about the plot per se. We'll talk about your character in a second. But you had to trim it down a little bit to get it to the theater. And so there were some people – after the show, there was almost like a spontaneous, you know, discussion with all these Agatha Christie fans talking about how they love this, and I wish this more. I wish maybe they shouldn't have cut this character or things. But the reality was that they thought the presentation was so good because they couldn't believe you were able to pull it off, because that is in the original book, a very large cast, and I don't think that really could have been done on a theater production that cleanly.
I think you're totally right, and one of the reactions that I think is most interesting is that even if it's a diehard Agatha Christie person coming to see the show, so many people know the title Murder on the Orient Express, but they don't remember the ending.
Yeah.
And of course I won't spoil it here, but it's a beautiful twist of an ending. And we, you know, when it's revealed on stage, you can hear the audience go, almost collectively, because of how, you know, sort of beautiful and twisted and crazy that this ending is. And again, like a total classic murder mystery whodunit.
We won't, because there are a lot of people that haven't seen it. And once again, if you want to inspire kids to get into the theater, holy cow, I cannot think of many great productions that you could take them to. They'll understand it, they'll follow it, and then they'll just be in awe. I mean, there are very few shows I've ever seen put a staging on like this. It's exceptional. We've talked enough about that, though. Let's talk really quick about your character, Hector McQueen. Tell us a little bit about that character.
Hector McQueen, he is one of the American characters in the play. He is, I would say, the sort of secretary or number two to another character named Ratchet, who's sort of like a gruff American businessman dealing with imports and exports, traveling internationally on the Orient Express. So we're sort of a twosome in the first half of the play, and then things get crazy from there.
Yeah, you really can't tell. We can't really tell too much.
It's
more.
It's hard. I can tell you where I start, but maybe not where I go.
Yeah, you've said it perfectly there. Let's talk a little about the rest of the cast, because once again, you get into an ensemble like this. It is, mm-hmm. you got to learn the trust of working with everyone else, because your character does do indeed have a lot to carry there as far as your role goes. Talk a little bit about that and working there, and as you get back to that, you know, those rehearsals that you did, I imagine it was a great time to kind of feel out the rest of the actors and make sure that they understood and saw where things were going to go.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that was one of the beautiful things about this rehearsal process, was just being able to spend so much time with each other as actors and sort of discover our histories with these characters, how they relate to one another. Another really beautiful thing about this piece is the cast is made up of half locals and half out-of-town people. So we sort of got to bring a lot of new energy into the room while sort of having people who have worked with each other before. It was really this lovely mix of perspectives and sort of methodologies in the room. And I think we really created something really special that, you know, really shines on stage.
It does. It does. And it is, it's one of the best productions I've seen of a play, period, let alone at the Guthrie. And that says a lot there. Once again, that's Murder on the Orient Express. That's running until July 2nd. You can go get tickets. If you can get them, you want to get them now because this will sell out pretty much, I imagine, for the rest of the run. So you want to get tickets now before that ends, right before the 4th of July. Tyler, I will have one final thing if I can ask you. And obviously, you are an insanely talented actor. I'm hoping, first of all, are you gonna? Is there another Guthrie production that you're looking at down the line here?
A couple next season. I can't say out loud what they are, but some exciting projects next season for sure.
For you as an actor, what's it like to be able to work with the Guthrie on a recurring basis? Because I mean, it clearly is. I've lived in smaller towns, and I love theater. Local theater is always fun. Local community theater, some of the nicer theaters there. It truly is remarkable to have a theater of this caliber here in Minneapolis. And for you, talk a little bit about your association there with the Guthrie and working with them on the multiple plays that you've been there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's it. I think it's the caliber of the theater that's done there, the type of the theater, you know, focusing both on classics, but also these really interesting, engaging, newer works. I've been working at the Guthrie for probably the last 8 years on and off. Mm-hmm. And, you know, besides the caliber of the theater, it's also the people. I mean, the people inside that building making the art are really lovely to work with. And that sort of community that we've built around that theater is just really lovely to be a part of, and I'm honored to be a part of it.
I took the tour years ago, and they said the best part about our theater is that everyone who does what they do wants to do that job. And he said, and he says that you don't understand how great that is to be in a theater where the people that do the lighting want to do the lighting. The people that are doing the production want to do the production. There is no crossover. And it shows because it comes across as professional as anything you'll find. London, New York, it's just exceptional. Tyler Michaels King, once again, Hector McQueen in Murder on the Orient Express. All my best. Thank you very much for being in this play. Look forward to your next presentation. I've got seasons, so I'll see you on the theater over there. But thank you very much. I really appreciate the time today.
Thanks so much, Matt.
Take care. Tyler Michaels King, Hector McQueen, Murder on the Orient Express, July 2nd. That's when it ends. And you do want to see this. If you like theater, go see this. This is nuts. What they do on that stage with the sets is nuts. There are a handful of things theatrically I have seen in my life where I watch and just the set itself kind of becomes the star celebrity. And this is one of them. This is one of them. It really is amazing how they've done this. And so I can't encourage you to go see it enough. Murder on the Orient Express at the Guthrie. Go get tickets. Like I said, they will sell out the rest of the shows. 952-946-6205. Let's take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205 is the phone number. Go see that. You know, go see that. It is remarkable how good the Guthrie this year. Holy God, has it been good? It's been remarkable. It has really been remarkable. And I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed seeing these productions and, indeed, that Murder on the Orient Express. Plus the fact that it's fun. I mean, you're looking at, like, you know, the Knives Out and the Glass Onion, the Benoit Blanc, whodunits, which are very much in the line of Agatha Christie-esque kind of things. They're just fun if they're done well. And we had Larry Millette on not that long ago. About maybe a year and a half ago, to talk about his a locked door mystery. And I said, you know, how, you know, sometimes these are the hardest things to do. He said, yeah, I believe it. I mean, trying to figure out, you have to figure out the crime yourself. And, you know, and as far as Agatha Christie goes, I mean, there's a handful of stories which would probably be the premier level ones she wrote, and Murder on the Orient Express is one of them. And so, and I thought they were, did the case. I will say this once again, I was mentioning the Agatha Christie fans who are in the audience that kind of did an impromptu little class there on it. One or two of them were a little bit, well, I didn't like that they cut this. And I actually stopped them and I said, you do understand they have to do a play here and that a play is not a movie. And they'll watch the movie and they'll say, well, why can't it be like the movie? Well, because the movie's a movie and it's done in a very specific way. You've got a theater. You've got a theater. You can't. I mean, you can't have, you know, 5,000, you know, 500 people on the stage. You got to kind of trim it and kind of keep it tight, especially with a script like that. So I thought they did a magnificent job. Go see it. Seriously, go see it. You'll enjoy that. At 952-946-6205. So we talked over the winter a few times about removing snow from the sidewalks in Minneapolis and what would it take for us to get to a point where the city took care of all the sidewalks and plowed them just like they plow the streets. Well, a new report here says city-led snow and ice removal from Minneapolis sidewalks would cost just over $40 million annually, according to a new report. The analysis released Tuesday estimates the program would cost the city around $116 million to phase in over the course of 3 years. After that, the annual cost for sidewalk clearing is estimated to be $40.6 million for capital replacement, fuel and materials, labor and snow removal and disposal of each subsequent year, not including inflation. Under current city ordinances, property owners are responsible for clearing snow and ice from sidewalks that are adjacent to their property. Single-family homes and duplexes are given 24 hours after a snowfall has ended to clear snow and ice, while all other properties have 4 hours after snowfall has ended to clear snow and ice. The public works and infra, and well, I mean, if that's the case, then how? There's a lot of people that don't remove snow. I was over at it was the Museum of Russian Art. I went over there, and I was over there twice this winter. And you have to park kind of on the city streets there. Tons of people not clearing their snow. And making for a mess. And as a matter of fact, for me, reminder, this is when I just was starting to walk around again after the back had been broken. And so I could not really go on ice. So I literally had to wait till no one was coming and then kind of walk down the road till I got to a clear spot I could get through. And you know, maybe that's why I'm more on board with this idea of clearing snow, because I had my own experience with trying to navigate a world where in your ideal world, oh yeah, the snow's cleared, it's all done, people just do it themselves. The reality is there's a lot of people that don't remove the snow and the city doesn't really seem to care about that. And so I think that's the case. I would also say there's some videos I saw this year of the Canadian cities and how they – I mean, my God, you want to talk about a synchronized, you know, ensemble. My goodness. It was a team of plows and trucks and you know, guys driving these mobile snowblowers and, you know, the removal of all these streets. They show it. It's kind of hard to even comprehend. They had a snowstorm. I think this was in Montreal. They had a snowstorm, looked to be like, you know, a foot of snow. In come these plows. And within a very short period of time, the streets cleaned, sidewalks are completely cleaned. It looked magnificent. And you're like, okay, how, you know, this is Canada. I mean, we're basically Canada light. How are we not doing it kind of similar to that? And, you know, I think it's time for us to ask that question because, frankly, we do not. As much as we like to think to ourselves that we're inclusive and we have opportunities and we make things easier for people who are handicapped or disabled, the reality is we don't. And you know, how many times did I see stories this year of people in wheelchairs not able to get over mounds of snow that had been left there by the street plows on the sidewalks. Heck, I live in Hopkins, and you know the sidewalk clearing where they get them there, it's just not something that they're doing that much. Now, I'm not saying necessarily it's about Hopkins, but you know, your larger cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul, I don't see why we shouldn't have some sort of coordinated clearing system that takes care of the sidewalks. And yeah, I understand it's going to cost some money, but maybe if we didn't have police, you know, settlements to have to pay out in such massive amounts, we would have a few extra bucks to actually spend on stuff which would benefit us all. Because, I mean, let's face it, every single one of us would benefit – every single one of the people – excuse me, not us because I don't live in Minneapolis. But all the people in Minneapolis who are homeowners or just people going to the store or going down to the shop or are just trying to cross the street would benefit from this service. They said their further exploration of the city-led sidewalk removal program would be fully implemented by 2027. The report does not make any recommendation to the city leaders, but you know, frankly, I think that you're at a point where, you know, if you took care of that, it just makes your city far more accessible. That's what that does. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. A quick update on Trump and any of the more breaking news on that, and then. I got a story out of Blaine. Holy cow. I'll get to that in a second. It's the Matt McNeil Show on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. I got to read some more stuff for you for this Trump thing. This is nuts. And once again, I want to be very clear here. Any Republican who is blindly defending him without looking at this, you deserve the grief you're about to get because you're whataboutism or this is just political. Dude, the Times previously reported prosecutors gained access to notes taken by one of Trump's lawyers. The notes reflect what Trump told them, which according to the indictment included, I don't want anyone looking through my boxes. I really don't. I don't want you looking through my boxes. And another statement, another thing that he told his lawyers, according to the indictment, he told his lawyers, wouldn't it be better if we just told them we don't have anything here? Well, look, isn't it better if there are no documents? Talk about lying, breaking the law. The indictment of Donald Trump accuses him of showing military document about the plan of attack against another unnamed country to a writer, with the former president admitting that the material was secret and acknowledging that he lacked the power to declassify it. The indictment was a transcript from an illegally recorded conversation that took place at Mr. Trump's golf course in Bedminster, New Jersey. He freely admits to the crime. It includes an exchange between the former president and an unidentified writer and a staffer to Mr. Trump. According to the indictment, states that he found the document that was a plan of attack of an unnamed country. The quotation in the indictment suggests Trump showed the document to the writer and possibly even provided the document to read. See, as president, I could have declassified it. Could have declassified it. He's acknowledging it wasn't declassified. Now I can't, you know, but this is still a secret. So, shh. Now I added that shh part at the end. A staffer responds laughing, yeah, well, now we have a problem. I don't know. Laughing as in, oh, my God, laughing? The recording could present a problem for Trump's defense, showing he knew some of the classified documents he kept remain classified. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. What an absolute slimeball. One theme emerging from the account presented by prosecutors in the indictment of former President Donald Trump that was unsealed on Friday was that even after months of relentless news reporting on the case, Trump's handling of classified documents was more cavalier in his efforts to obstruct the government's attempts to retrieve them, more blatant than was previously known. On nearly every one of its 49 pages, the indictment reveals a shocking example of Trump's indifferent attitude towards some of the country's most sensitive secrets. And its persistent willfulness in having his aides and lawyers do his bidding in stymieing attempts by the government to get the records back. At one point, the indictment includes an almost cartoonish image, quoting notes from one of Trump's own lawyers. It relates how the former president made the plucking motion there. Just pluck it out. A classic example of knowing a speaking indictment, the charging document, which was filed on Thursday in Florida court in Miami, did far more than merely lay out seven crimes that Trump had been accused of, among them obstruction of justice and the willful retention of national defensive records. The indictment also showcased the bedrock elements of the former president's personality. His sense of bombastic and vengeance, his belief that everything he touches belongs to him, and his admiration of people for their upper-handed craftiness and gamesmanship with authorities. It recounts, for instance, how Mr. Trump had only praise for an unnamed aide to Hillary Clinton, who, at least in his narrative of the story, helped Mrs. Clinton destroy tens of thousands of emails from a private server. He did a great job. The indictment quotes Mr. Trump as telling one of his lawyers. Why? Because in Mr. Trump's account, the aide ensured that Mrs. Clinton didn't get in any trouble. As baseline material, the indictment gave the clearest picture yet that the highly sensitive records that Trump took with him when he left the White House at starting collection of covert material that included documents in the U.S. domestic nuclear programs. Just unbelievable. Unbelievable. One thing the indictment does not assess was Trump's motive in taking the documents. It laid out extensive case for why he shouldn't have taken the sensitive national defense material, including some information about the U.S. nuclear programs, and that he clearly knew he had material that he shouldn't have had. But despite the Justice Department subpoenaing materials related to foreign business deals, there's no suggestion in the indictment that trading on the documents for business purposes was part of what he was doing. Well, you got to take a look at what he had. But at the same time, can I say this? Regardless, tell me a country that didn't break into Mar-a-Lago and get access to these things. I mean, for goodness sakes, we know Chinese agents were walking in the Mar-a-Lago. We know Chinese agents were walking in there. Unbelievable. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205 is the phone number. It sounds like, and by the way, I just got a brief on this here. Where did it go there? Nonprofit health system pauses policy that was cutting off patients for debt. That's right. Allina Health, the large nonprofit health system in Minnesota, announced on Friday it would stop withholding care from patients with outstanding medical debt as it reexamines its policy of cutting off services for those who have accrued more than at least $4,500 in outstanding bills. The health system will now temporarily halt this practice, but it will not restore care for indebted patients who have already lost access. Although Allina's hospital treated anyone in emergency rooms, other services were cut off for indebted patients, including children and those with chronic illnesses like diabetes and depression. Patients weren't allowed back in until they paid off their debt entirely. So, you know, and once again, this is an organization that's a nonprofit, and one of the reasons they get the breaks they get is because they're supposed to take care of the poor. And this is them saying, the poor ain't paying enough. Allina's chief executive, Lisa Shannon, called the move thoughtful pause. No, the thoughtful pause, Lisa, should have happened before you put this policy into place, you greedy bastards. How about I say it like that? On behalf of all the people that you just denied medical care to as a nonprofit medical facility, the heck with you. How about I say it like that? Dr. Matt Hoffman, an Allina primary care physician in Vadnais Heights, said he was encouraged by the change and hopeful that Allina would eventually make more significant reforms on how it treats indebted patients. Basically, your health should not be dictated by how many zeros you have in your bank account. Something you would think a nonprofit for, you know, that has a duty to help out the needy would know. 952-946-6205. So let me jump into a different trajectory because I got to get to this before the end of the week. A group of community leaders, advocates, and residents in Blaine want a new city council member to resign for allegedly making racist and anti-law enforcement comments. The Blaine Coalition for Racial Equity is calling on council member Leslie Larson to quit just after 2 months on the job and wants the city to take up a resolution in support of her resignation at its June 20th meeting. We need council members who are committed to respecting that we have minorities who live in our area, said Ashton Ramsamy, a public policy analyst and one of the group's co-founders in the interview. Council members need to be held accountable for their words, and city council members need to be willing to work with all groups. Larson won a special election in April to fill the vacant Ward 2 seat in Blaine. Several attempts to reach her by phone and email were unsuccessful. I have zero doubt she's not exactly taking calls. About a month before the special election, a Blaine resident compiled comments Larson allegedly made on social media and posted them to a Blaine Facebook page. The comments were deleted shortly afterwards, but another resident preserved the messages before they disappeared. Ramsamy learned of Larson's comments from the election when they surfaced on Twitter, according to the formation of the Blaine Coalition of Racial Equity. In 2021, a comment with Larson's name appears on a Care 11 Facebook page with a comment about the charges against former Brooklyn Center police officer Kim Potter in the fatal shooting of Dante Wright. Too bad she wasn't employed at the Capitol instead. Killing citizens is encouraged there, and your work is called bravery and courage, the comment said. And in the apparent reference to the January 6th attack insurrection on the Capitol. So basically what she's saying is that Kim Potter, it's a shame she wasn't one of those police officers there, because you know, and the kind of the impression is that she is a supporter of Ashley Babbitt and feels like she was unjustified there. So if she would have been there, not only it would have solved two problems or whatever. I don't know what she was at, but clearly it implies there that there is not only a dismissing of the charges against Kim Potter, which once again she was held guilty, accountable for, but as well this implication that the people that tried to stop the country from being overthrown were somehow out of line. That doesn't seem to be nice. In a January 27, 2022 post on a different thread, Larson allegedly wrote, are you ready? You ready to strap on in here? All right. Can we also all pretend to be black so we can all have a chance of becoming a Supreme Court justice? Wow. 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 That's a little racist. Ramsamy also objected to language on Larson's campaign material that said, keep Blaine suburban, not urban, with the words not urban underlined in red. Okay, I'm going to stop you right here. Hey, Buttercup, have you been in Blaine lately? You see that Central Avenue out there where you have all those people coming into the Blaine, you know, sports complex out there? That's a freaking nightmare. It's one of the worst roads in the entire city. In the entire city. I'd rather take 94 during the rush then go down Central. So you're already urban there in Blaine.
I'm
with you on that one. Larson's statement suggests the urban areas are undesirable because they are associated with people of color or low income, Ramsamy said with a press release. It reinforces negative stereotypes about urban areas and people who live there. Actually, I'll say this. Urban areas are fantastic. I love living in Minneapolis, St. Paul. I was just down there last night, as I mentioned. Getting out of the parking ramp, you know, for a ghost town, there was a crap load of people in that parking lot. Or those ghosts are driving a lot of Kias. There are a lot of people in the downtown. As a matter of fact, it came up, was it third? So you come up right from the Jawa Sandcrawler, that's the U.S. Bank Stadium, and you go down 3rd Avenue. There was like four bars right there that were packed to the gills. One or two of them looked really cool, man. I got to go stop by over there. And then, of course, got onto Hennepin Avenue, fairly packed out like this. That was like 10:30 at night on a Thursday. Larson's suggestion, once again, that urban areas are undesirable because they're associated with people of color. About a quarter of Blaine's residents are people of color, apparently compiled by Minnesota Compass. Ramsamy said the coalition would be open to starting an effort to recall Larson, but the North Metro suburb of more than 70,000 residents has no formal process to remove an elected official. That really sucks. The group is urging the city's charter commission to implement a removal process for ethics violations in the next 60 days. City spokesman Ben Hale says the commission last year had started developing that process and is expected to bring it forward as a proposed charter amendment this year. Council members sign a code of conduct agreement when they start their term. Haley said the comments in question were made before Larson was elected. Doesn't mean they're not offensive, for God's sakes. Blaine Coalition for Racial Equity members also want the city to form a diversity, equity, and inclusion commission to create standards for the city and host a DEI workshop with all city council members. With the diversity of Blaine, it's important we have standards in place. And that's a fair thing. You've got a quarter of your town is made up of the minority population. So you sitting there and saying we should, you know, implying that we need to keep, you know, white suburbia in existence sort of thing. And that's at least the, you know, the way he's taking it. And I've got to tell the truth. I'm with him on that. That's how the implication comes across. And you're more than welcome to come on this show and clarify what you really meant by that. But, you know, yeah, I think that you're considering you're dealing with a population that is fairly diverse up there. I don't know why you are, you know, this needs to be addressed, Blaine. This is not good. Larson's resignation isn't likely to become an agenda item immediately, and Blaine, council members bring topics of discussion to council workshop sessions. If a topic gains support there, the city staff could add it to a future agenda, Hale said. Members of the community, however, can bring up topics of concerns during the open forum on each council meeting, Hale's added. We can ask the council to take a motion asking her to resign, said Ramsamy, which is going to probably be the case. Which, frankly, you know, like I said, first of all, I find it hilarious that, you know, they posted all these things up here and she frantically delete, 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 tries to delete all this stuff and thinks that's how it all works. That's how the technology works. We had as well, was it Columbia Heights had the council member, and they're still dealing with that one down there where there was an unfortunate incident. You can't – I get it to a point for the standard far right-wing guy that lives in some of these suburbs that you are sitting there and when you bought your house or you moved in 20 years ago, there was still some farm fields next to you and – you know, all the kids in your kid's school were all white. You know, there wasn't any problem. And now all of a sudden, those people are coming in here. And the fact that you put that on your campaign literature, I mean, let's put aside the comments you made on some of these things. That was your campaign literature. It's clear who you were trying to appeal to with that message. And it's something that I've seen, and we saw it, trust me, before Eden Prairie became blue, and before Minnetonka went blue, and before Plymouth went blue. The reality is that a lot of these districts had Republicans there who basically just, you know, they would try these same things, and they eventually kind of got pushed out. And it's moving further and further out from the center core because you know what? Hate doesn't sell. And you're up in Blaine, and I get it. You know, you want to think Blaine's Elk River. It's not. Elk River is still pretty far away. But Blaine is, like I said, just go out on Central. Go 65 there. How many chain restaurants do you have out there where you need workers? And, you know, most of that's not going to be high school kids anymore. Most of that is, you know, minorities coming in and working these jobs. And you need them to work these jobs because this is where your bread and butter is. You got that sports complex there, brings in a lot of people. You need the fast food chain restaurants. You need all this stuff out there. So, you know, it's you better have people there that are not trying to take yourself back to 1970 when there was hardly anyone up there that worked in the metro area. And frankly, if I was on a board, I was on a committee or a board, and I found out that any other member of the committee or board was making comments like that, even if it was before they became a board member, the first thing I say is, you know, why are you here? We have 25% of our population is minority. Why are you here if this is such a problem for you? and, you know, make them squirm, or at least make them say, well, I'm here for the white people. And then you can get rid of them pretty quickly. And at the very least, she should be out there apologizing profusely to the residents of Blaine for her comments, because, yeah, she sounds kind of horrible. She sounds that way, at least. And until she clarifies what all this stuff is about, 952-946-6205. Some dancing music for you on a Friday when we do return. It is the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. To be fair, there are some Republicans that are trying out there desperately to take this party back. Asa Hutchinson became the first candidate for the Republican nomination to openly criticize any Republican who's rallying around Donald Trump, to projectively say that this is a result of political prosecution is not a service to our justice system. He says, so good for him. Michael Broadcorp also has a very blunt summation that regardless of whether or not you think this is just sized up, the indictment unsealed today is the most perilous legal situation Trump has ever faced. Republican candidates for president and elected office can't ignore the gravity of this incident. And he then does a very good job of assessing the fact that if Trump is the nominee, then forget about the Republican Party in 2024. I don't know how in the world you get away from him, though. I don't know how they get away from him, because that's that he's going to be the nominee because they can't help themselves. This is what he is, their id. He is everything that they wish they were. Selfish, jackassian, narcissistic, getting away with it all. And they love him. And I don't know how you get away from him, but he's going to be the nominee. I still can't see anything that's going to, it's going to change the Republicans on this. So good luck with all that. No, seriously, good luck with all that. Taking us out today, Dury, our good friends Dury. I have to have them back on the air here before too long. They've got a new album coming on out here, and they're going on tour, and they got a pretty heavy duty tour is going as well, and they're heading to London in September. These are these guys out of Burnsville, Dury. I love these guys. I heard this song for the first time. I swear, I think this is the song of the summer. Enjoy it. It's their newest one, Coming of Age, from Dury. Have a fantastic weekend. We are back on a Monday. Till then, see ya.
Lost its taste, and the 6 o'clock train's always running late. But if I stop now, I know I'm never gonna make it.